from the home of creative writing on the internet, live and uncensored, this is Litopia After Dark. Featuring a fusion of lowdown gossip and lofty debate. All hosted by Litopia's Peter Cox.
Hello and welcome to Litopia After Dark, the net's first and foremost writers' salon. We feature a mixture of old friends and frequently a few new faces too, drawn from the worlds of writing, publishing, media, culture, and the arts generally. Our agenda is pretty simple. If it's interesting to writers, it's important to us. On tonight's show, the US election. So far, it's been an offence fest of name-calling, but what makes us give and take umbrage? Our panel goes on the offensive to find out. The newspaper is dead. What's coming next? And could whatever it is also be the future of the book publishing industry? And do you blog? Or is blogging already rather passé? All this plus best-selling cats, JCBs that write books, How to Be a Pope, and Across Europe by Kangaroo. Just a smattering of the lovely shiny objects in store for all of us and our jackdaw minds in tonight's Litopia After Dark. But first, let's catch up with the Writing Week.
The Writing Week in 60 seconds.
No change in the New York Times hardcover fiction and non-fiction lists this week. The Lucky One by Nicholas Sparks and The Snowball by Alice Schroeder still reign supreme. Dewey by Vicky Myron is at the number 3 position in non-fiction. Like Merle and Me, it chronicles the true life exploits of a human and a pet, in this case a kitten, left freezing in the returned book slot of an Iowa public library. And just like Dewey, Vicky knows a few things about hardship, being a single mom who's lost the family farm and survived an abusive husband. Do you get the parallel? Not too subtle for you? I'm afraid it gets even worse. Dewey, part cat, part therapist, performs minor miracles in this recession-hit Iowa town of the late 1980s. He gives depressed townsfolk a reason to live. He heals the sick, he resurrects the dead, and he finally defeats the Antichrist, all before library closing time. Then Sarah Palin defers her nomination to Dewey, creating a landslide for John McCain, who expires on inauguration night, thus giving Americans the first pussycat president they've ever had, and the best they've ever had too. All right, I made that last bit up, but it's because I'm choking on the biggest furball of schmaltz you've ever seen. It's like Lake Wobegon without the irony or the humour. Vicky's made a few million dollars out of Dewey, and you can't knock success, of course. It just goes to show, there is no way on earth to underestimate the public's appetite for pets, sentimentality, and small-town schmaltz. Pass me the kitty litter, someone. That's what's been going on this week. Remember to keep up to date with our companion podcast, Litopia Daily, 5 days a week. In tonight's show, we welcome from Fort Lauderdale, writer and leading lawyer, Donna Ballman. Donna's first book is A Writer's Guide to the Courtroom, due to be published in May next year. She's also working on several young adult writing projects, and, as you know, she presents The Write Report every day on Litopia Daily. And from England's West Country, Dave Bartram. He's working on a novel for the young adult market, and he's also a lecturer. Also from England, Richard Howes is one of the first students to be accepted for Britain's highly prestigious National Academy of Writing. And from Edinburgh, the capital of Bonny Scotland, comes Eve Harvey. Eve's Litopia's podcast officer. She's working on a young adult novel, and you can hear her heartening brogue 5 days a week on Litopia Daily, where she presents Eve's Salmagundi Club. And that's our unreconstructedly old school panel for tonight. Right, team, settle down. By the end of tonight's show, I want to make a few million pounds, or dollars would do, from schmaltz. Yeah, and I need your help. Donna, what are your top three schmaltzy ingredients?
Well, I write for kids, so I'd have to say princesses, unicorns, and How about orphaned main characters?
That's always a good one, isn't it? A good old standby. Orphaned main characters, he said, scribbling it down furiously. Sounds like a recipe for success to me. Richard, I like the kitten from Vicky Myron's Dewey. In my story, should the cat be dry and cold or warm and wet? Should I indulge myself with a number of felines, or is that going too far?
Well, Bruno Tognelli, I'm sure you watch Strictly Come Dancing on a weekend. I think he'd go for the warm and wet. As for the number of felines, an ancient proverb says, two cats are a circus, three cats a coup, and six cats are a revolution. Yes. So do not become a cat magnet.
That's such good advice. You know, my mother said that to me some years ago now. Dave, I've got princesses, unicorns, and orphaned main characters, and of course cats. What are the plot points am I missing for a surefire bestseller? Maybe a disabled child, an adult with a mental condition, maybe a Christmas setting? I don't know. I feel I'm missing something still. What is it?
Well, there's a couple of things. Firstly, the cat could be blogging from a secret location where it's been kidnapped in the North Midlands.
Good.
You know, that could be a nice touch. Yeah. You know, but the disabled child could actually need an operation. Goes into hospital just before Christmas. Turns out it's an alien for whom it's perfectly normal to have four arms, one eye, and four assholes.
Oh, such a heartwarming ending. I love it.
We haven't got there yet.
Oh.
This is the day do more. No, there's more. And all he wants to do is go home. Okay.
Yes.
Now, the FBI are after him, and the only person who can stop the FBI is the miser who's been feeding all the cats, and he has the FBI man's cat, and he gives the FBI man his cat just before Christmas, because it's really important it's before Christmas, because it's a Christmas alien on a special errand for Santa, and if the alien doesn't get freed, there'll be no Christmas.
Yeah, I think I've seen that film, actually.
Yeah, a million times. But you need all of those things.
Oh, I'm feeling a bit daunted by that, but good advice, of course. Eve, should I feel ashamed, do you think, of making a fortune from all this low-quality, over-sickly sweet nonsense?
You really think you're going to make a fortune?
Well, we live in hope, don't we?
You're damn right you should. Hang your head in shame for foisting such pap onto the poor public. Your penance shall be to share your ill-gotten gains with the panel, and we'll say no more about it.
I see. I think you've got the better end of that deal, actually. All right, well, now we've learnt a bit about our panel's schmaltz factor. I think it's time to get on with the rest of the show.
And now, the most hotly anticipated moment of the show. It's time to play Pitch the Nasty Agent.
Yep, the idea is simple. I'm going to give you a book title each, and you've got to pitch it back to me as if you were in some sort of nightmarish editorial meeting. If you're a regular listener to Latopia After Dark, you'll know the form, really. And this week's titles are all taken from How Stuff Works, 17 unusual book titles. Haven't got time to go through all 17, but let's start with Donna. And your unusual book title, Donna, is How to Make Love While Conscious by Guy Kettlehack.
Well, this is a story about a billionaire's wife who goes off the drugs and alcohol and, finding consciousness for the first time, realized she's married a warthog instead of a handsome prince. So she befriends a cat that provides her comfort and advice. She adopts an orphan disabled child. She goes to volunteer at a home for adults with mental conditions. The cat, the child, and she bring the disabled adults much
joy at
Christmas.
You've written this with Dave, haven't you? It sounds just like Dave's plot to me. I can't tell the difference now. I'm sorry. Go on.
There's no aliens in mind. Sorry.
Have we finished?
That's it.
Okay, great. All right, well, Dave, we're going to have to ask you to mark that. How many out of 10?
Well, it's so good. Apart from the aliens being missing, it's fantastic. So it's a 9, isn't it?
It's a 9, yeah. See? You would have got 10 if you put aliens in. Dave, you've got one here. Be Bold. It says, Be Bold with Bananas by Crescent Books. I don't think that's a person's name, do you? I think that's the publisher. Be Bold with Bananas by Crescent Books.
Well, it's a double-edged title in that Bananas is the name of a little man who talks in a strange guy's ear and advises him what to do, and advises him to wear nothing but bananas. to eat nothing but bananas and work with nothing but bananas. And he becomes kind of a little demigod in a small suburb of Chicago where there are no aliens, and pontificates and says wise things in a very simple way, a bit Forrest Gumpy, but with more bananas, and ultimately saves the neighborhood just in time for Christmas.
Yes. I thought we heard that already, but no, of course, no aliens. So I'm getting really mixed up on this. Richard, would you care to mark that, please?
Oh, I think that's better than last week, so I'm going to give it a 7. I'll mark it down slightly because of the double reference to Christmas now already, so yeah. It's a 7.
I'm getting a bit bored with that, yeah. Okay, 7. That's more, certainly more generous than last week.
Christmas is so passé.
It is passé. Well, it will be passé soon. Richard, you've got one here. It's called How to Be a Pope, What to Do and Where to Go Once You're in the Vatican by Piers Marchant.
Well, actually, they've already changed the title. It's How to Be Dope, What to Do and Where to Go Once You're in the Vatican. And actually, it's a memoir. It wasn't Pope Benedict the Nazi who got voted in by the cardinals, no. When the cardinals gathered together in St. Peter's, a twist of fate, a prank vote, accidentally puts Sean Puffy Coombs of Puff Daddy fame in the hot seat. With crazy witticisms like "That is dope" and "Who shot my biggie," PBD takes up the mantle of the semi-free world's mostly rankled faith and brings Catholicism into the 21st century. Sunday will never be the same again, as Piddles realizes when the world sheep declare war on the Vatican for an address that includes big butts, bling, and guns, that being the head of the Catholic faith isn't all it's cracked up to be.
I think that's fantastic. I mean, I'm speechless, really. What'd you say, Eve?
I see 10. That is brilliant.
Yeah,
that was brilliant.
It's got to be a 10. It's got to be a 10.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your title in this nightmarish commissioning meeting, Eve, is Across Europe by Kangaroo by Joseph R. Barry.
Okay, actually, I'm going to educate you all with my pitch for this book.
You always do.
No schmaltz from me. Mm-hmm. It's a tale of environmental salvation. As we all know, a herd of cow belches out more climate-changing gas than a family car. However, Skippy, our environmentally friendly kangaroo, has a bacteria in its stomach that means its farts have no methane at all and no environmental consequences. So this book is the recounting of a journey made by the aforementioned kangaroo as it braves its way around Europe, educating our herds in greener flatulence activity and saving the planet. It's a real tearjerker.
Nice. I think that's really heartwarming.
That's true, actually. That's true about kangaroos.
Yeah, but is it a nicer smelling flatulence as well?
It's perfumed.
You can just see that, actually, can't you?
Chanel number 5.
Well, you can just see that at Christmas time, sort of some sort of weird Australian sort of aftershave kangaroo fart. And then it's just the sort of thing they'd do. Donna, what do you think? Marks out of 10? You learned something.
Well, I did, and I'm always in favor of books that educate the public on how to be more green, so I'm going to give it a 9.
It's a 9. Woo-hoo! Fantastic. Well done, everybody. Richard soared into the lead there with 10 points at the end of our first round. Eve, Donna, joint second with 9 points. Dave, some harsh marking, it's true, fair but firm, with 7 points. But, of course, there still is a chance at the end of the show for all these scores to be completely upset and toppled as people compete for the Litopian of the Week title.
Look out, world. It's time to rumble.
Let's get ready to rumble.
This is the moment when Litopia's literati lock horns. The Brannigan of the Week.
Yes, that's right. These are the subject of the week, the news items that have caught our eye. First one is this. Well, excuse me. Last week, you must remember, we took a look at this sex and blackmail scandal that propelled etiquette doyen Emily Post to start peddling good manners as a commodity nearly 100 years ago. This week, Emily Yoffe writes in Slate, all the links, of course, in the show notes, you know that, about the lack of manners, as if we really expected them, in the US election campaign. This presidential campaign has been an offence fest, she says, from the indignation over a fashion writer's observation about Hillary Clinton's cleavage, to the outraged response to the infamous Obama New Yorker cover, to the histrionics over lipstick on a pig, taking offence has been a political leitmotif. Slate's John Dickerson observed that umbrage is this year's hottest campaign tactic, and we can assume it will reach an operatic crescendo in these final weeks before Election Day. Well, I'm sure that's a safe bet, but why exactly do we take offence? After all, they're only words, aren't they? But sticks and stones apparently don't hurt us as much as the trivial insult does. Candidate John McCain was recently quoted as saying, "I've been known to forget occasionally the discretion expected of a person of my many years and station when I believe I've been accorded a lack of respect I did not deserve." Well, personally, my view, if anyone wants it, and if you don't, I'll be really pissed off with your lack of respect, is that our leaders ought not to have a hair trigger. They should be slow to anger, particularly when they're fingering a nuclear trigger. But McCain's sentiment is certainly in step with the times. Law enforcement officials see an alarming new trend out there. They call it low flashpoint killings, in which attackers resort to deadly violence over the most trivial of confrontations, almost invariably related to a pathological need on the part of some young men for respect. So, panel, are we angry tonight? And if so, why? What do you say, Donna?
Well, I'm not particularly angry this week, but I think that what we're seeing in the political campaign is a lot of really phony moral outrage, trying to make trouble where there's none. And I mean, the whole thing about the lipstick on the pig is nonsense. And they finally had to admit that it was nonsense. But I think it's a sign of desperation in a failing political campaign.
Mm. Well, Dave, go ahead.
I think they realized that the only way to sell themselves is to go for the celebrity angle, but unfortunately they don't have the style or panache to kind of carry it off, and it just ends up being, you know, oh, look what they said about this and look what they did here, and you know, it's not about politics at all, is it? It's a scrum.
Yeah. Dave, do you think we're giving and taking offence more generally as a society, not just politics?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it stems from the fact that we've eroded meaning in almost everything we do on a daily basis. You know, there's nothing terribly significant about what most people seem to do these days, or it's not accorded any significance. And I think that's why people focus more and more on these tiny little nuances and this, that and the other. And it's understandable because we all do it. I do it. But yeah, we do, definitely.
So you say it's down to the lack of meaning.
Yeah, I think the overkill of infotainment that we get and the low-level garbage we get through the TV and so on has actually eroded any sense of meaning in life. I mean, you've only got to watch EastEnders a few times to actually feel absolutely dismal about the pointlessness of everything.
Yeah. Oh, and you I don't, think, do you?
No, I don't personally. I don't watch it or feel particularly dismal about the pointlessness of everything, but a lot of people do because that's what they're fed all the time. And there's this... Yeah, all these clothes programs and style programs, everything's focusing on the minutiae of this, that and the other. And that's just filtering through into our moods and emotions, the way we relate to other people.
Yeah, so a trivial offence results in someone getting killed.
Yeah.
Mm. Eve, given any good offences recently or received any?
No, I'm very calm and nice. I blame Red Bull, actually.
Yes.
I blame all those the active drinks and stuff. They've got so much caffeine in it. After a few coffees, I can go a bit, but mostly, no, I'm but no, I honestly think they're a lot to blame. I can lash out a bit, and I'm not like that. I don't have that. But drink one of these caffeine drinks, and people are drinking like vodka and Red Bull down the pubs at night and stuff, yeah. And it's not good. And I think that's got a lot to do with people's.
It's the vodka, isn't it? It's not the caffeine.
I think it's Red Bull. Mm. Honestly, I have found that it does send your temper rate. But people are nice to me and I'm nice to them. And I think if you're quite a calm person and have a big smile, nobody really offends you.
Yeah. You've been a bit touchy recently.
It might be worth saying at this point that Red Bull or any other similar high energy drink.
I'm sorry, yes. Any other, yes. It's all of them.
You don't want to get sued by Red Bull for saying that they've been the cause of the rise of street violence.
That's legal advice there from Dave. Thank you very much. Richard, has it been tetchy recently? A little bit too much of the old caffeine shakes at all?
I don't do tea, coffee, energy, and high drinks. I do a lot of chocolate and chocolate biscuits and chocolate cake. And I'm normally quite on the edge side of anxiety and energy. But I've got a puppy recently, and she's winding me up something chronic. Yeah. So we get into a lot of offensive language between us.
Yeah. We've got, was that your puppy?
Somebody sold you a cat dressed up as a dog.
Grief. Oh, no, sorry, it's ours. So sorry. Oh, sorry, go away now. No, go on.
Is that new from Stourbridge today?
Yeah, no, oh, it's a bit of a... Go away. Excuse me a minute. Okay. Yeah. Terribly sorry about that. What were we saying? Oh, yes. Next item, newspaper of the future. Well, you know, on the Taper After Dark, we've often looked to the present plight of the newspaper, partly because they still do employ some writers and review books to some extent, and also because the present state of the newspaper business may well be an indication of what might happen to the book publishing business in a few years' time. Some people call it the canary in the coal mine. The current issue of the American Journalism Review carries a think piece by Philip Mayer, who's pretty well known in these areas. He's a professor emeritus in journalism at the University of North Carolina, in which he tries to predict where the industry is headed. The end game for newspapers is in sight, he says, rather depressingly. The internet wrecks the old newspaper business model in two ways, he continues. It moves information with zero variable cost, which means it has no barriers to growth, unlike a newspaper, which has to pay for paper, ink, and transportation in direct proportion to the number of copies produced. And the internet's entry costs are low. Anyone with a computer can become a publisher, as Matt Drudge demonstrated when he broke the Monica Lewinsky story in 1998, and countless bloggers have shown in the decades since. These cost advantages make it feasible to make a business out of highly specialized information, a trend that was underway well before the internet, he says. Well, he offers a sort of future vision of the newspaper in which newspapers that do survive will do so with some kind of hybrid content, analysis, interpretation, and investigative reporting in a print product that appears less than daily, combined with constant updating and reader interaction on the web. He also believes that the newspaper's most important product is community influence. It gains this influence, he says, by being the trusted source for locally produced news, analysis, and investigative reporting about public affairs. This influence makes it more attractive, he believes, to advertisers. Well, are we optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the newspaper? Remember, the situation is a bit different in the US compared to the UK. America's only really got one, maybe arguably two, national newspapers, and regional papers in the UK have less influence than they do in the US. Donna, as our resident American, what do you read daily? Mainly the print or mainly the web?
Well, we actually get three daily newspapers. Ooh. I read two of them, and I also read a bunch on the web. So I'd say 50-50.
It's 50-50, is it? And have your habits changed at all in the past year or two?
I read more on the web, thanks to the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Eve, I mean, you're the counterpart, of course, on the podcast. I mean, same question, really. What do you read daily? Is it the print or the web, and has it changed?
It's the web. I don't buy a newspaper. My mum saves. I buy the Scotsman occasionally because it's sort of more relevant, but I can get that online as well. But my mum saves things like the Critique for me, which you can't really get access to much online, the things that involve books and reviews and stuff. I used to buy a daily newspaper until it offended me with a story that I didn't like. I can't remember what it was, but it really annoyed me. And then I stopped buying it.
You took offense. And,
and I read it. I read on the web now. Yeah, I use News Now filters out the literary stuff. Sorry?
Is it the same paper you still read online? You just refuse to buy it?
No, I avoid it altogether now.
Do you want to stop reading the Daily Sport?
Yes, it was the pictures of me. Dug them up from years ago. No, I read News Now, which filters out the literary news for me, and then I've just got my main BT homepage tells me the headlines, and that's pretty much what I look at.
See, that's what I have BBC News for.
Well, Richard, do we still need newspapers?
Me personally, no, but then I'm don't really have the brain energy for reading the high-end Times and the Independent and the Guardian that I feel have the proper articles in it. You know, the things like the Daily Mail and the Sun provide, I can get quickly, painlessly off the BBC News, you know, read it for 5 seconds, work out what it's about, and move on. You certainly don't need to buy a paper for that sort of thing these days. And with a lot of the stories that change between the print actually running and the story's development, you know, you're too far behind with physical paper. Although I did see recently that the Cambridge had developed the first e-paper, which is being produced in Germany at the moment, and because it's plastic technology, it's flexible, it's thin, it's pretty much weightless. It's about the same size as a magazine, and of course you could then, you know, subscribe to whatever papers you want and download it. You don't have to then go and have to keep discarding all this paper and buying new ones.
Yeah, well, that's the environmental cost, of course. Dave, would you read, do you think, a less than daily paper and maybe catch up on the web? This is the model that Mayer is suggesting. But do you think that, does that strike a chord of reality for you?
Well, a lot of people only get the Sunday papers and nothing else, don't they?
Yep.
So I suppose it's already a model that exists. I don't buy a paper at all anyway, because most of them are full of complete shash, of course. Mm. And there's one or two that aren't, but most of them are full of absolute rubbish. And they do have, I mean, there's one thing where the internet will not supersede newspapers, of course. I mean, Richard's just got a puppy, so he'll know all about that.
Indeed.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. What will I do when they get
rid of
the paper?
When they get rid of, yeah, fantastic use. And probably the best use for many of them, I think. I think possibly. I read a weekly paper. It is the local papers, I think, are the things that are going to survive.
Yeah.
Rather than the nationals.
They are
poo, but down here, you know, if you want the Guardian, you have to specify. You'll get given a Cornish Guardian. You won't actually get given a Guardian unless you say no, the other one.
Hmm. Would you think if we lost our to a large extent, say our national papers, do you think that would have any effect politically? I mean, do you think newspapers these days? He's going on about investigative reporting. I'm kind of rather surprised he does, actually, because as far as I can see in the UK, at least, and possibly less so in the States, it's a really, you know, endangered species. And I rather wonder whether newspapers do actually fulfil that role anymore. But I don't know. What do you think, Richard?
Cool. Yes, I suppose so, you know, because the BBC have always been, you know, possibly in problems with whether or not they're in bed with the government. So yeah, you know, the flip between the Daily Mail and the Express, the Times and the Telegraph, you at least get some kind of broad spectrum about who believes someone said what, you know, which if you're going to get rid of that and you don't have a bespoke source, you know, a few bespoke sources like the papers to kind of go back to get what the generalisation of the story is, there's a lot of it's going to get lost in translation.
Yeah. Well, connected with newspapers, of course, intimately connected, some would say connected with their much-predicted demise, is, of course, blogging. And it's fashionable amongst the digerati at the moment to proclaim the death of blogging. I know, personally, I've substantially decreased the amount of original blogging I do, and instead I spread whatever time I've got available between Twitter, which has got a 140-character limit, and, of course, podcasting. A piece in this month's Atlantic, Andrew Sullivan, a former editor of The New Republic, explains why he still blogs. From the first few days of using the form, he writes, "I was hooked. The simple experience of being able to directly broadcast my own words to readers was an exhilarating literary liberation. Unlike the current generation of writers who've only ever blogged, I knew firsthand what the alternative meant. I'd edited a weekly print magazine for 5 years and written countless columns and essays for a variety of traditional outlets. And in all this, I'd often chafed, as most writers do, with the endless delays, revisions, office politics, editorial fights, and last-minute cuts for space the dead tree publishing entails. Blogging, even to an audience of a few hundred in the early days, was intoxicatingly free in comparison, like taking a narcotic, he said. He believes that despite all the intense gloom surrounding the newspaper and magazine business, this is actually a golden era for journalism. The blogosphere, he says, has added a whole new idiom to the act of writing and has introduced an entirely new generation to nonfiction. It's enabled writers to write out loud in ways never seen or understood before. And yet, it has exposed a hunger and need for traditional writing that in the age of television's dominance had seemed on the wane. Richard, do you think blogging's on the wane?
I do. I kept one up for two solid years.
Yeah.
I did quite well with it. But no, I must admit, I am a former... Do I have to stand up and say this?
Yes, you do.
I've been dry now for 2 months.
Really? It's just yeah, 2 months. What tipped you over the edge, actually? Have you totally given up on it, or what?
I can't say forever, because obviously I've still got the blog up there, you know, running away with itself. But it's just they're having the time, and certainly they're having to think of stuff to put on it. You know, when you're trying to do proper work,
yeah,
know, IT support or whatever, and I'm trying to do my course, and I'm trying to do pretending to write a book, and trying to do God knows what else. I just don't have that time to sit and think about, well, what could I blog to do with writing today?
Yeah,
you know, and then you look at the pure number of blogs that are out there, and people who are established and have a sufficient readership, and you know, they're just, it's like newspapers. There isn't a need for another one.
I think that's my feeling. There's an enormous numbers out there. But Eve, I mean, you do spend some time partly jointly blogging with other people on Vulpes Libres, but also going through other people's blogs. I mean, what's your take on this? Is it just a sort of a trendy thing to say that blogs are dying, or what?
No, I don't think there. I think there's a core out there. I think if you're telling people, I got up this morning, I had breakfast, blah, 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 then I don't think you're going to get anything. You have to be now. You really have to be new and original and come up with something pretty shit hot to get readers. Yeah. We are quite established in Vulpes Libres now. We have a large number of followers, but there's very, it's like a triangle kind of thing, a pyramid system. There's a few towards the top, and then as you go down, there's all the people talking about their lunches. And if you're going to blog now, you're going to have to be really, really, really pretty innovative. I suppose it's like writing, isn't it? It's like all the books that are coming out, you have to be pretty new, do something completely different that attracts people now. And I mean, the way it works for us is because there's 15 of us, so we all take a shot, and there's not the pressure. Plus, we pretty much do what we want, and it's mostly just reviewing books or interviewing, or you know.
Yeah,
it's easier to keep it up if you're not having to do it every day. I couldn't.
Well, I find that too in my time of life. But writers, I mean, writers that are told almost sort of, you know, all the time from all kinds of sources, our agents, publishers, and who knows what, that they've got to blog. You know, you've got to be on the internet. You've got to have. I mean, I think Random House has just recently set up a whole sort of area for all their authors to, you know, to desperately start getting their own websites together and blogging and so on. Do you think this is sane advice then? I mean, do you think it actually does make any difference to the average author's book sales? And doesn't it just sort of consume their time? What do you think?
No, I don't think that it's necessary. I mean, it's all about striking up that presence and making people aware of you. But it always comes down to the fact that if people are going to read your books, they're going to read your books. They might read your blog, but for the majority of people, they're not. So it's a case of you're going to build up a fan base, but you know they're going to come in and they're going to read what you had for lunch, or you went. You know, it's nice to read that you went off to this book, whatever, and you learned this, and you met a few people. Well, hey, but it doesn't add anything to anybody else's lives, and it's kind of going down that celebrity route of just getting the author constantly out there.
Yeah.
But what really is the quality of that output? You know, I like the kind of sense of mystique of the writer and not really knowing who this writer is that
me
you're
too.
Reading.
Me too, you know? Absolutely. I think there's a good reason to be to stand a little way apart from your readers, actually. It doesn't cast daylight on magic.
You have the few writers who are sufficiently well, like Terry Pratchett and J.K. Rowling, who everybody knows about, and that doesn't diminish their writing as such. But you know, if you had every writer was out there and you saw all their faces and it was all over the place, it just kind of muddies the water.
Yeah, Dave.
I think you can do the same with a website with some occasionally updated content. I think you have to have some sort of place for people to go, but I don't think you need a blog, which can look, if you don't update it often enough, can look as though you can't be bothered. Whereas if you have just a website, you know, with a, you know, occasionally changing it to where you're going to be or what you're going to do or whatever. But a blog can look as though you don't care. Sorry.
The innovative thing to do now is for two writers to start up a feud whereby they're always nitpicking. You know, like Noel Gallagher.
Well, we could do that tonight, couldn't we? Somebody could get a fence and...
That's, you know, rubbish, Rish. Pack it in.
Who did that to my cat? I'm going to kill you.
Yes.
Getting good value out of that, aren't I? Dave, just a quick comment on this sort of, you know, thing that both Richard and I tend to feel, actually, about the importance of having a bit of distance there between writer and reader, or indeed, actually, between sort of consumer of any creative thing and the creator. Does that ring a bell for you, or what's your position on that?
I think that's critical. I mean, you want to engage with the world that's created, not the author. I mean, it blows it out of the water, doesn't it? Mm. Jeff Van Der Meer does a fantastic job of that in, can't even remember the books now, but very clever creation of this weird persona, and it's hilarious. I mean, I started a blog, and I was interested that the guy said it was like a narcotic, and he just must have had some really shit gear if that's the best he could make as a comparison. Get a better dealer if that's your parallel to, you know, what are you on, man? Obviously nothing.
He's probably talking about Prozac or something.
Oh, yeah, or aspirin or Advil. Yes, exactly.
But there's I've noticed a little sub-industry. I think it might be coming to an end, actually. I think it's probably about time. Production companies making videos of authors. It's usually publishers that pay. And publishers, you know, sort of say, oh, well, you know, we've got to have the author up on YouTube. And, you know, you see no end of these videos with the author just looking just like, you know, a deer in headlights, really. What do I say? Help! Can I get away from these nasty hot lights? And at the end of the day, you think they spent some money and wasted a bit of time, and what have they actually achieved?
No. Yeah, I saw some agent guy looking at book covers on YouTube once. What was he playing at? I don't know.
Oh, no, I saw that too. That was just, wow, waste of time that was.
I don't know.
David Bridges.
But if you look at a really clever video that's promoting a book, you can really get some buzz out of it. But it shouldn't be just the author yammering away. Brad Meltzer did a great one on Book of Lies, where he got Joss Whedon and Chris Hutchins and some other folks to do a video for him. And if you can get those kind of folks to do your book video, then great. You know, you're going to get some buzz for sure.
Mm. Well, David Bridger I'll just bring this in from the chat room. David Bridger makes a good point. He says, thing is, there are horses for courses. Many readers love to communicate with their favourite authors on blogs, particularly youngsters. And of course, that is true.
Well, Stephanie Meyer really did a good job of reaching out to her fans. And she didn't just do a blog. She set up her own website where people could get to know her a little better, because she wasn't really happy with the publisher's website. But she also reached out to some fan sites, and they were writing about her book. And she reached out and answered some questions and stuff, and was really proactive in reaching out.
Well, yeah.
In 5 years' time, she'll sue them for doing a book on a glossary of terms for Twilight and whatnot.
I was looking at one of these celebrity things. It was William Shatner's website, because I followed a link about him being upset about not being invited to Sulu's wedding.
What is up with that guy?
And it was...
get over it, huh?
He's crazy. He's a sucker.
Yeah, it was... Crazy stuff. And if that's what all the kind of websites are going to be like, oh dear. But I have to say, to the YouTube side, I thought the book trailer for Invisible City was pretty good, actually. I actually thought that was quite intriguing, because she was wandering about in the Mayan ruins and stuff. And
it's true.
That was,
Yeah.
Quite cool.
Good.
You know, so I think it can be done well.
Thank you very much. Look forward to seeing a trailer from the next author who's got a book series deal. Might be a bit difficult, actually. Another day, another publishing deal. I'm proud to report a book deal by a new writer, JCB. Yeah, that's right, JCB, the digger. JCB, the manufacturer of bright yellow diggers, has got a book deal. You may wonder how a JCB can write a book. Frankly, Katie Price managed to do rather well with a stream of chart-topping bestsellers, so it shouldn't be too hard for a JCB, should it? Especially if it has a backhoe or trencher. Maybe a stump grinder will allow it to hold a pen a little better. Maybe with the use of some duct tape. Yeah. Well, the publishing deal grants global rights to Peter Haddock Publishing, which is part of the DC Thompson Group, of course, up there in Dundee. Books featuring the illustrated My First JCB team of machine characters will target preschoolers 2 to 4 years, while a further line will be aimed at older boys 4 to 8 years by focusing on real JCB machines in action. Sam Johnson, Kids Brand Manager at JCB Consumer Products, said children of all ages have a fascination for JCB machines, from giant excavators to our dancing diggers. Yeah! Publishing represents a natural progression for our licensing program and is a great way to tap into the excitement created by our diggers. We are confident that Peter Haddock Publishing will deliver a fun and bold experience that's true to our brand in this area. Well, as an agent, I can hear the cash tills ringing now, getting very excited and thinking of a Free to Be, You and Me, JCB, or The Tale of JCB the Bard, or Where the Wild JCBs Are, or JCB Wars, of course, or The Little JCB on the Prairie. I just think this is a franchise that could run and run. You ever driven a JCB, Dave?
Not an actual JCB, but diggers and stuff. Yeah, absolutely. It's quite good fun. I did see a video the other night, actually, with rednecks using a digger to they get hold of a bit of wire held by a digger, and then they'd swing the arm around real fast and fling them into a pond. And it was kind of a sport thing.
I wonder if there's a
quite
book in
exciting,
it.
Exciting, actually.
Yeah. So, Eve, if you had your own JCB, and we all want our own, really, don't we? What's the first thing you'd do with it, do you think?
With the recent weather we've been having, I'd dig a moat. Absolutely. We're flooding here. We're flooding. I used to have a boyfriend when I was 5 years old who was obsessed with JCBs. Mm-hmm. And we lived in a tiny village, and a JCB appeared one day to dig up a muddy patch of ground. It was such a romantic date.
Yes.
Watching the JCB.
I just got a mental picture of it just then, actually. Went all misty for a second or two.
That's the 1980s film, isn't it? It's got to be.
Was the 70s,
actually.
Yes. Yeah, lovely.
So, Richard, any other mechanical instruments, do you think, or household devices that deserve their own publishing deals?
Well, clearly the dildo.
What?
That was my suggestion.
No. Two great minds thinking, can't get out of the gutter. You know, I don't think that's too bad, actually. I think that's rather an interesting idea.
Yeah. Apparently there's a lot of money in erotic fiction.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
And that's if you mix it in with the kids, you know, you've got both.
Yeah.
Both angles covered. You could do an adult version.
You should take this offline. Yeah. Sign everybody up straight away. I think there's a... Going to give up the schmaltzy stuff. Let's get into this. Thank you very much, panel. We've really chewed the fat this week. We could, of course, talk all night. But right now, we have to give some urgent advice to someone in trouble.
Got questions? We've got the answers. It's Litopia's Cry for Help.
Yeah, we've just received a telephone communication from the private jet of Mr. R.M., because nobody has to give their real name on this, of course. I must say, he sounds Australian, but he assures me that he holds an American passport. He says, "My business is international news. I own thousands of TV channels, millions of newspapers, a leading publishing company, and one film and TV company. Oh, and your dish and hard drive recorders are mine, all mine. You'll never find a way to get out of the contract. Ah, ha, 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 ha." He goes on to say, "I own almost the entire world of media. The downturn in sales and advertising is hitting me hard, and people are saying that my business model won't work for too much longer. I'm thinking it's time to sell up. What should I do in my well-earned retirement. Oh, and there's a PS. He says, I'm very wealthy, so I don't want no gardening suggestions, all right? Yeah, tricky one. Dave, can you help?
Yeah, I think given, you know, the man's genial and kindly disposition, I would hate to see him exposed to the turmoils of the world once he's retired. So he should sell up, buy himself a huge, or build himself a huge underground bunker and seal himself in it for protection.
Sounds good. Yep. A lot of people do that, but, you know, it must be a reason they don't, I suppose. Donna, what do you think?
RM, I think you should give all your money to the Democratic Party to atone for your sins, then go volunteer at a soup kitchen.
Yeah, ain't going to happen. Richard, any advice?
Well, I'm trying to convince my dad to go to the local college and take up a course in photography. So if he wants to, you know, somebody to pal up with, he can go down there. That's fine.
That sounds pretty good. Good, nice offer. Thanks, Rich. I'm sure, you know, he'll be in touch on that one.
Being at the age of retirement, he'll get it pretty cheap as well.
Yeah. David Bridger, chat room, says RM could try midnight water skiing from the back of his yacht. That's another nice constructive suggestion. Eve, what do you think?
That's my suggestion. Since we're heading into a period of recession, I think he's right to sell. I think she should get a luxury yacht and head off to the Med or the Canary Islands or something
like
that.
Take up water sports, certainly with it going liquidized.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Not terribly creative, but a lot of people do it, so must be something in it. Well, thank you very much, everyone. I think that's been incredibly useful for RM. You've certainly reached out and touched an elderly billionaire tonight, which just may change your luck, although for better or worse, I couldn't say.
It's time to play Toad Suck Arkansas Reverse Shuffle Six Card Strip Poker Red.
Oh, yes, this is the bit you've been dreading. We keep on threatening to change it a little bit, change the format around, and, you know, we will at some point. But right now, it's going to stay pretty much the same as it always has been. And I think you probably know the drill by now. I'm going to think of a person from literature, a character, author, personality of some sort, maybe real, might be fictional. It's up to our panel to guess. They ask me questions in turn. I'm only going to answer yes or no, but I usually get my arm twisted and give a few extra clues as well. And when the panelists are ready to make a guess, they've got to wait until it's their turn. That's right, Dr. Sue, we're talking about you. And it can't be a turn in which you have already asked a question. All right. Now, this is where the poker bit comes in, of course, because you can hazard all or some of your remaining points. You start off with six points, six guesses, and it goes progressively downhill from there, as things tend to. And for listeners to the podcast only, I can exclusively reveal that this week's subject is, or perhaps I should say are, the Smurfs. The Smurfs. Now, I'm thinking, Donna, ask me a question.
Are they American?
They are not. No, they're not. Dave.
Is this a character from a book or rather than an author?
Yes, it is. Richard.
Is it a male?
Pretty much. Yep. Eve.
Is it an animal?
Not really. End of round one. Donna, your guess, please. Oh, I'll tell you what. I'll give you a clue. Why not?
Not really.
Yeah, I don't think you're really focusing at all. At least 500 years old. At least 500 years old. Donna.
Okay. Is it a children's character?
Yes, it is. Good one, Dave.
Does he try to steal newborn babies?
Not that I know of. I don't know everything, but you know, I've never heard of that. Richard.
Is he a wizard?
There's a little bit of that. Yeah, a little bit, but I wouldn't say totally, wholeheartedly, completely, but I mean, it wouldn't be too far wrong to say there's a bit of wizardry about it. Eve.
Does it live in sand?
In sand. I do actually know what you're thinking of. No, it doesn't. And that's the end of the second round. And I'm
Do you know what the real name of it was, Eve?
Yeah, the Samoyed.
Samoyed.
Five children and it.
Very good. No.
Is it it?
Yeah, it was just because we kept saying it.
Well, somebody ought to ask me that. Beginning of round three, I'm going to give you another clue because, honestly, guys, you're not really focusing at all. Associated with an artificial language. Donna.
Okay. Is it human?
I would say not. Dave.
Associated with an artificial, not human, but male.
And 500
years old. Male-ish. Oh, as he said, male-ish.
Male-ish, yeah, mainly.
Male-ish.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Oh, that. male-ish, not American, not an animal.
Not really an animal.
Not really an animal. A male-ish, not really an animal. Well, that's most of the Tory party. 500 years old artificial language.
He's a bit magical, slightly.
And he's a little bit magical. Hmm.
See, it's it.
I'm writing that. I've got a little list now. Little bit magical. I'm seeing if there's a pattern in the letters or something. Like, oh, I don't know. Is his middle name Bob?
No. Gosh, you took a long time to ask that, didn't you? Richard.
Crikey. Right, so...
Yeah. You're very serious tonight about this, Richard. Glad to see you taking it seriously.
Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
What was that name?
Do you know? You knew.
Probably not, but something just popped into my brain.
What is it?
I can't tell you. It's not my turn.
Tell me on the side. I don't want to hear. It's just me listening. Everyone look away.
No. It's probably complete shash anyway. So I'll project it with my incredible ESP mind powers.
Oh, are you getting, yes.
Yes, it's Valerie the Vibrator.
Is it Henry VIII's left testicle?
Are you seriously asking me that?
No, I'm not.
Oh,
animal 500 years old. Possibly slightly magical. Is it a clanger or a moomin?
No. Oh, you're trying to get two for one there. That's not fair. I'm going to take your first answer. No, it's not. Eve, your question.
Is it alien?
No, it's not. End of third round. I think I stand a chance this time. All right, I'm going to give you one more clue. I really oughtn't to, but I'm going to. Donnie Darko. Donna.
Oh.
Hope I can't hear those keyboards.
I have no clue. Is it from a... Well, no. I'm really stumped here. The character's more than five. Oh, is the story more than 500 years old?
No, definitely not. Dave.
Well, I'm going to have a go at what I was thinking, and it's probably rubbish anyway. And I'll bet...
You've got 3 points left.
I'll have to bet, because I get double per point, don't
you? You do.
So the only way I could win is if I bet two. Not that I'm hooked up, that sort of thing. I'll bet 2 points.
Yes.
And I would suggest, is it the Jabberwock?
No, it's not. An intelligent guess, sir, but I'm sorry it wasn't. Richard.
Is it a rabbit?
Is it a rabbit?
That was my question.
You said
Donnie
Darko.
It's not a rabbit.
I'm thinking of that, or it's some kind of godhead.
It's not a rabbit. Eve.
Oh, that was mine. Is it a rabbit?
Oh. I like to take
it. You could ask me if it was a hare.
Is it a hare?
No. Oh, that was an easy point for me, wasn't it? All right. End of round four. Only two rounds left. Phew. I think I'm going to win this one, but I'm going to Hell, I don't know. Why not? I'm just going to throw in another clue because I'm reckless. Accused of being crypto-Nazi.
Hey.
Yeah.
Your clues are a nightmare.
Accused of being crypto-Nazi. Donna, round five.
Is it blue?
Yes, it is blue. Ooh, I shouldn't have given that last clue. Dave, you really ought to miss this round because you bet 2 points last time. Richard.
I don't know. Crypto Nazis and blue.
Yeah.
You're off the scale.
I think someone's got it already, Richard.
Donna's got it.
I think Richard Donna's got it. Unless your Eve can be really, really sharp now. I think the game
I've basically thrown it by asking that question because I already knew the answer. I was trying to give everybody a chance.
Oof.
Oh.
Come on.
I forego. I'm not wasting my points. I'm going to hold on to what's left.
Well, you can't. There's no point. Donna's going to get it this round, and I have not.
You might as well guess something.
It's blue. How many blue characters are there, for heaven's sake?
I don't know any blue.
You know the song Blue, Dabba Dee Dabba Da.
You're going to kick yourself when you realize.
Richard, any last minute guesses? If not, then it's Eve.
No, not at all.
No. Okay, Eve.
No, I don't know what it is. I can't think of any blue characters whatsoever.
Ask him if it's a cartoon.
Oh, what?
Come on.
All right. Okay, Donna.
Yes.
Donna, you got to say it, Donna. You got to say it.
Yeah. I've got to say it?
You got to say it.
It's a Smurf.
It's a Smurf.
A Smurf.
500 years old?
Yes. According to Smurf.
Only 50.
That's right, but the Belgian cartoonist Peyo introduced Smurfs to the world in a series of comic strips, making their first appearance in the Belgian comic magazine Le Journal de Spirou on October the 23rd, 1958. They were called Les Choutrompes, but according to the mythology that he spanned, they were indeed 500 years old. They had a birthday yesterday. I was going to tell you that, but I thought that would be a little bit too easy. Associated with an artificial language, yes indeed. The Smurfs replace enough nouns and verbs in everyday speech with Smurf as to make their conversations barely understandable. We're going smurfing on the river Smurf today, for example, if you excuse my accent. When used as a verb, the word Smurf typically means to make, to be, or to do. Smurfs understand each other due to subtle variations in intonation. A human character attempting the language, asking for a glass of Smurf, implicitly water, is misunderstood by every Smurf who each assumes another item. Donnie Darko. Movie Donnie Darko contains a scene in which the characters discuss the sexuality of Smurfs. And crypto-Nazi, yes, only just, I think today, actually, on the BBC website, somebody put an amazing comment. I'm just going to read quickly. I haven't got this guy's name, but it's worth reading in full. They're a group of ethnically pure, all blue men living in a utopian agrarian community with a solid work ethic. The only woman in the village is introduced as an evil plot to subvert the Smurfs, but she, as a pure Aryan with blonde hair, turns out to be chaste and pure. Gargamel, the evil sorcerer who attempts to destroy the Smurfs, bears an uncanny likeness to Nazi depictions of Jews, and the, quote, the only gay in the village, the camp one called Vanity Smurf, is forced to wear a pink flower to mark him out from the others. Well, so there. Did anybody love Smurfs when they were small?
Yes.
I love Smurfs.
Yes.
Well, the evil Gargamel.
I was too old to really have this get into the Smurfs that came out after I was a little older.
Yeah.
All right. You're already 50.
I don't know about Smurfs. I prefer trolls, actually. Smurfs always just a little bit weird, I think. Anyway,
I've got don't some. Know how to Smurf it, do you?
Exactly. Now, guys, I've got some adding up to do. It's a little bit simple tonight, but still, I've got to get my calculator out.
It's getting tense. It's getting sweaty. It's time to crown the Latopian of the week.
That's right. Yes, and of course we do have a very clear winner indeed. In last place, but very worthy nonetheless, is Dave with still 7 points. Well done, Dave. Okay, you gave very good value for money, I thought, and harshly judged.
Absolutely. That's that Rich. I don't know.
Yeah, judge not. Yeah. He may be judged. Yeah. Eve was next with a creditable 9 points. Always a good performer, Eve. Richard, 10 points.
Pretty, can I get the silver?
Pretty, yes. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Possibly you even can get to stroke my pussy cat if you want. But Donna jumped from 9 points round one. Brilliant guess, of course, got 2 points, which is double one. The poker hand to score 11 points, and Donna therefore becomes our Litopian of the week.
Yay!
I tried to throw it. I tried, guys.
You just get these too easily.
Well, we could go on all night, really, couldn't we? Having fun with our Smurfs. But all good things come to an end. I don't really know where Smurfs go in winter, but we're probably going to go there for a little hibernation. And it only remains for me, really, to say thank you so much for our fantastic old school team tonight. Everyone was absolutely terrific and great form. Of course, Donna, Dave, Richard and Eve, thank you very much, team, for being with us. You were fantastic. Show notes will be up on the website. As always, got some contributions for us, please make them. There's a link on the show notes to our open inbox as well. So thank you very much, everybody. Good night. Happy weekend.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Writers Colony, www.litopia.com. Show notes and links mentioned in this program can be found on our podcast website, podcast.litopia.com. Litopia After Dark is recorded before a live audience on Ustream every Friday at 8 p.m. London time, 3 p.m. New York, 12 noon Los Angeles. Come along and be part of the show. Full instructions on the website. If you like what you've just heard, tell your friends and post a review on iTunes. We'll see you next week.